If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Where to Go. I'm James Atkinson, Senior Brand Manager at DKI Eyewitness.
And I'm Lucy Richards, Senior Editor at DKI Eyewitness.
And welcome to Where to Go, where every fortnight we find out more about the world's favourite travel destinations with the people who know those places best. And today, we are in Madrid.
We are in Madrid. The season finale.
The season finale. I should have mentioned that at the top of the episode. Yes, this is, listener, this is our last episode of this season. Fear not, we'll be back really, really soon. But we've got a cracker of an episode for you.
We really, really do. I'm really excited. I know I said this about every episode, but I am genuinely super excited to go to Madrid with today's guest.
Yes, absolutely. And I don't know tons about Madrid. It's horribly, one of my childhood best friends, Alan. Hello, Alan.
Hi, Alan.
Moved there about 15 years ago, and I promised him a visit for a long, long time, and I've never done it.
Oh,
and
no, so James.
I'm due to go to Madrid at some point, so I'm really interested to find out more.
Well, my friend Tom lives in Barcelona, so I've been to Barcelona. Hi, Tom. Barcelona umpteen times, but he is potentially moving to Madrid. So, James, we have got to make it our 2024 mission that we are going to go to Madrid.
Yes, let's do it. Let's definitely do it. And likewise, I've been to Barcelona quite a few times. I've been to Valencia, been elsewhere in Spain, but not Madrid.
I know.
And it's a big, big hole missing.
Yeah, that we need to fill that hole.
Yes, so let's do it. Before we start though, we have a competition for you guys, listeners. Yeah. So much like we did a couple of weeks ago with Vienna, we have a copy of DKI Eyewitness Madrid, as well as our new book, Europe by Train, to give away. To win, all you have to do is go into social media, tag at DKI Eyewitness, and tell us what our guest, Benjamin, we haven't introduced him yet, we will do, is talking about here.
But it certainly is a fun, colorful story that maybe says a lot about Spanish society or something. I don't know.
I wasn't expecting anything quite that grisly, I must say.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
So you can enter that competition now just by going to at DKI Eyewitness and telling us what you thought Benjamin was talking about. And you can find the T's and C's on our website. But should we welcome our guest, Lucy?
Yes, you've obviously hinted at Benjamin.
Yes. So tell us more. Tell us about Benjamin.
New England native Benjamin Kemper lives in Madrid, where he works as the travel editor at Sever, covering travel, food and culture. And he's also worked on various Spain-related photos guides. So he really is an expert. Welcome, Benjamin.
Thank you so much.
Hi, Benjamin. Welcome to Where to Go. So as usual, we're going to begin with learning a little bit more about our guest, Benjamin, followed by his all-important recommendations on where to go and insider knowledge of Madrid. Then we'll hear about the best time to go, plus how you can travel more thoughtfully when visiting the city. So, Benjamin, you have your cooking column, One Pot Bangers. You're a senior editor covering food and travel. It seems safe to say that food is a big, big thing for you. Where does that come from?
Boy, that's a tough question, but I would say that it started with my mom, actually. Like many people who are interested in food, my mom was a very experimental cook when I was little and would take me grocery shopping with her. We would spend a long time at the grocery store. I actually used to love going with her. And then when she would cook, she would often call me downstairs and she would ask me, you know, taste this. What do you think this needs? And this is, you know, we're talking about a very young age. And so I think that really developed my palate and got me really interested in food and flavors. Like I was the weird kid who had hummus in his lunchbox when, you know, in the 90s. and I come from at least on my mom's side, a big Jewish family, and food was always a really central part of our culture, as anyone who knows Jewish people can attest.
And obviously, Benjamin, you're king of travel, but when you're not working, does that food, that love for food, really influence where you're choosing to travel to?
Oh, totally. For me, the more obscure, the better. Less I know about a cuisine, the more attracted I am to the place. And, you know, when I'm on the ground in a new city, especially, one of the first places I go to is like a grocery store, just to see, you know, how people are cooking at home and what products they have there that might be different from what I can find in the US and in Spain. Like I just got back from Finland and I was shocked to find a half of an aisle devoted to licorice. I'm yes. Like, wow, these people love their licorice.
They
like,
love licorice. Okay.
Did you try any? Did you have some?
I did. You know, I really liked it. There's a certain saline quality to licorice that's really nice.
So how did you kind of come to live in Madrid? Was that entirely food related or was it kind of a food cultural thing?
Yeah. You know, I was a real language geek in high school and something about the sound of the language just really drew me in from a very young age. And then when I was 15, my town did an exchange in the summer with a Spanish school here in Madrid. And to have 50 to 100 15-year-old Spaniards coming from the capital of Spain to a small town in Connecticut, it was like quite the invasion. And they just fascinated me, you know, they dressed differently, they acted differently. And I remember thinking, this is a really cool culture. And so the following summer, I actually came to Spain and I stayed with a family here. And I just had such an incredible time, you know, living in a city, living in Europe. It was my first, you know, trip to Europe. And, you know, what they say is true about Americans. We come to Europe and we're like, oh, my God, the cobblestone streets, you know. And there's just a certain like joie de vivre that you really feel in Madrid. And I felt it at that age and I continue to feel it now. And so when I finished that month, I just remember thinking at age 15, like, I gotta live here, you know? And
yeah.
A lot of stuff happened in between. I went to college in Boston. I moved to New York and worked in hospitality, marketing, and PR for a while, and as a sommelier. But then, you know, the Madrid itch was always there. And so there's a program here called Auxiliares de Conversación, which is a really long and garbled way of saying language assistant. And it's one of the only ways for Americans to actually get visas to come to Spain. And so I decided I was going to take a year sabbatical, come teach English, screw around, travel Europe. And 1 year turned into what's 9 in September. So it's been a minute.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you've got the big 10th anniversary next year then.
Yeah.
Did you experience any culture shocks, Benjamin, when you moved?
I sure did. The biggest one, I think, coming from a very kind of work-centric culture and family in the States is that in Spain, people view work differently overall. So there are two things that really astonished me from the start. One is that, you know, you could be at a party meeting a bunch of new people and you'd leave and you'd realize that no one had asked you what you do for work. And in America, that would be unthinkable, right? That would be almost the first question that you ask. You're like, what's your name? Oh, cool. And what do you do? You know, there's something that's almost considered to be a bit vulgar about that here. It's a bit too intimate. Like, we're out partying. Why would we want to talk about work? And so that was, that was one thing. And then, and related to that as well is that I've never in all of my years here had a Spanish friend cancel plans because they had to stay late at work. It's just not in the culture. And that would happen to me all the time in New York. When I lived in London for a bit, it also happened. I mean, how many times do you get that text that's like, you know what, really sorry, can't hang tonight, got to stay late at work. It just, it's inconceivable here.
I mean, that happens all the time in London.
Yeah, and we're both nodding. Listeners can't see, but James and I are both nodding enthusiastically because I feel like I think I've done that as
I
well.
I feel like me and Lucy have cancelled plans with each other, potentially doing that.
Exactly, so that's
quite possible. But yeah, it's really interesting as well. And so would you say that they kind of like prioritise almost their outside of work time, their sort of family, friends time and stuff over working life?
Absolutely. And I think that there's also a certain sensitivity around employment because the unemployment is so high here. So I think there's a certain cultural element, but there's also just that kind of stark reality that especially among younger people, unemployment remains a pretty big issue.
Were there any other kind of culture shocks when you kind of moved to Madrid?
For sure. I mean, the meal times are totally wacky, out of control, bizarre. So, you know, Spaniards traditionally eat five meals a day. You have breakfast, and then you have the almuerzo, and then you have the comida, and then the merienda, and then cena, dinner. So, you know, you're eating little bites throughout the day. Now, most people don't eat like that nowadays, but one thing that has remained is this very, very late dinner time. So, you know, when my parents come and visit, they're used to booking a dinner reservation at 6:30, 7 o'clock. Well, most restaurants in Madrid actually don't even begin taking reservations until 8 or 8:30 p.m. So you can make a reservation at 11 p.m. at some restaurants. Unfortunately, I've kind of adapted to that culture myself, and I've become quite a night owl.
I was gonna say, have you adapted? Because I think, yeah, by the time, if I'm eating at 10 o'clock, I get a bit hangry. I don't know if you're completely past that now.
Yeah, I think I'd say I'm fully assimilated. It definitely helps that this time of year it gets dark at like 10:30 p.m. or something. It's just really long days.
Yeah, true.
How about a Spanish siesta then? Are you taking part in those, Benjamin? Is that a myth? One of do the Spanish really take siestas?
The Spanish, I would say overall, mostly don't take siestas anymore. But shops still close, especially family-run shops, you know, in markets, traditional markets, you know, between 2 and 5:30 p.m., that's when you can bank on most smaller businesses being closed. And frankly, this time of year when it's, you know, 40 degrees Celsius heat outside, 110 degrees Fahrenheit-ish, that siesta is almost like your body just asks for it, begs for it.
Yeah. I mean, actually, there's a good point there as well, where, you know, coming from New England, where it's mostly quite a temperate climate throughout most of the year, can get quite chilly in the winter, but 40 degree summers must be something else, right?
Oh yeah, I'm basically melting all day.
Sent out.
Yeah, I can see why you went to Finland now. But and sort of just before we get on with your kind of like best things to do and recommendations about Madrid, what do you love most about the city? What has kept you there for 9 years?
Boy, I mean, I just love that anytime I walk outside my apartment, there's stuff going on in the street. I just got back from the Baltics. I was in Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. And it was just so quiet. I went to the Baltic region on a solo trip, and I was just astonished by how quiet the streets were. Like, I would come out of the hotel and I would be thinking, where are all the people? In Madrid, you come downstairs and, you know, there's somebody sharpening knives in the back of his van. There are a bunch of elderly ladies sipping coffee on the terrace below my apartment. And, you know, that street life, that pulse, it's invigorating. And I think anybody who's been to Madrid and who's been to Spain, they might not get it on a first trip, but they definitely feel that pulse.
There's definitely an energy to sort of Spanish cities. So I think that's a really good introduction to your best things to do. So let's kick off that section. Okay, Benjamin, to kick things off, we're going to ask you a couple of quick fire questions about Madrid. So we're going to name a few categories and you have to just suggest just one thing to do. Are you ready?
Yes.
Cool.
Bring it on.
Okay. Well, we're going to start with your favorite view of Madrid.
Oh, this one's easy. This is a park called El Cerro del Tío Pío, which is also known as the Park of the Seven Boobies because it has seven kind of small humps or protuberances, if you will. And from there, you can see the whole Madrid skyline with the Sierra de Guadarrama mountains in the background, especially on a clear day. It's really great.
Stellar answer.
Excellent answer.
Started with a bag. I love it. Okay, Benjamin, this one I think you might find harder. Is your favorite thing to eat?
Whew, okay, this one for me has to be a slice of tortilla española from a market stall in Mercado de la Paz called Casa Dani. Okay. I love it because it's like ushy-gushy potato tortilla, like that family, like not cooked all the way through. And it also has lots of caramelized onions in it, which I personally really, really like. And yeah, you eat one slice of the tortilla. And yeah, if you ask me that question about the siesta again, you know, I might give you a different answer and just say it's mandatory.
Necessary, yeah.
Excellent. Casa Dani, remember. Okay, and this might also be quite, as a former sommelier, this might be also be quite tricky. Your favorite thing to drink?
Yeah, you know, I kind of stopped my sommelier career because I think I'm just maybe a bit more of a down-to-earth kind of guy. So my favorite thing to drink in Madrid is a vermouth, a red vermouth on any like patio, on any plaza, preferably with ice and a slice of orange and an olive.
Lovely.
Lovely. I also really like the fact that you added a setting to that answer. That makes the drink, doesn't it? Yes.
Gotta be outdoors. Totally. Like 1 p.m. 1 p.m. It's an aperitif, you know? So before you go and you have your big lunch, have a vermouth with no TH. V-E-R-M-U.
Got it. And then Benjamin, how about your favorite day activity?
You know, lately I've really been enjoying going to Casa de Campo, which is kind of the underrated park in Madrid. It's 6 times the size of Central Park. It's absolutely enormous. And there are all sorts of trails in there. But what I really love is this lake that they have sort of at the beginning of the park. And there are all of these lakeside restaurants where you can sit out right on the lake, you know, have a nice drink, have a nice meal. And yeah, I think, you know, spending the day taking a little hike and then finishing up with a nice cold beer on the lake. I don't know if it gets much better than that.
Agreed.
Don't think it really does it? And then moving on to your favorite museum or gallery.
This one for me, it has to be Museo Sorolla. So this is kind of an underrated museum. It's the mansion and home and studio of Joaquín Sorolla, who was a famous surrealist painter. The whole house is kind of kept the way that he left it and is just filled with all of art that he either painted himself or collected over his life. It's one of those museums where you can be in and out in an hour and feel like you really saw some cool stuff. So yeah, that would be my choice for best museum. And it's going to be very unpopular response because, you know, the Prado is here, the Reina Sofia, the Thyssen, all these incredible like gold mines. But for me, I love a kind of a digestible museum.
It's a really good answer.
Great answer. Really, really great answer. I think you've passed with flying colours the quickfire round.
Woo!
I've never known anyone to do the quickfire round so quickly. Well done,
but eloquently as well. You gave us really lovely context. And, Thank you, Benjamin.
And you slightly dropped in a little bit of like kind of some other alternatives too.
I aim to please.
I was going to allow you just to quickly kind of given food and drink is very much, you know, a big thing that you've based your writing career on, the opportunity to just give us one or two more things to eat or drink should you wish to share them as well.
Ooh, yeah. Well, I'm really big on old school kind of Spanish Castilian comfort food. So I think that you really cannot leave Madrid without trying the classic winter dish, which is cocido madrileño, which is a stew that's sort of brimming with, I don't know, 10 different types of pork products. You have your chorizo, blood sausage, pork belly, usually a whole chicken goes in there as well. And it's just one of these like all out Madrid feasts that everybody should try. I recommend trying that at a place called Malacatín in La Latina, which is pretty delicious, but make sure that you book it in advance because that's the place that a lot of locals love to go as well.
Okay.
I also love, along in the same vein, there's a dish from the north of Spain called fabada, which is, it's like a bean stew. It's sort of Spain's answer to cassoulet. And what makes it so special is that the beans are called faves de la granja, and they're like about the size of your thumb. They're really, really long and really, really creamy. And the soup is, it's just so simple and smoky and delicious. And you can try a great version at Casa Hortensia, it's called, with an H. God, I could go for days.
is that a kind of like a vegetarian soup then? Or is it with sort of different meats and stuff as well? Or can you get varieties of it?
A vegetarian soup in Spain.
Wow.
Good one.
I just wanted to make sure. It's good to know.
No, I mean, listen, there are plenty of vegetarian options for people who come here, especially if you kind of stick to like all the potato things are fabulous. But no, the stews are pretty hardcore and they always have some type of pork and usually a mixture of pork and beef and chicken kind of all mixed together. So this particular dish, fabada, is made with blood sausage and chorizo and pork belly. And all those are extra smoky because that region really loves its smoked meats. And then, you know, I always encourage people to kind of branch out, get out of their comfort zones a little bit. Madrid is a city where you can try some really fabulous kind of off meats, off cuts. Madrileños love kidneys, pig ear, sweetbreads, things like that. And a place to go and try all that stuff is Casa Toni, T-O-N-I. It's in the city center. It's a really old school kind of greasy spoon spot. But, you know, if you've never tried pig ear before and you want to give it a shot, this is the spot. They do a really, really good job. They've been in business for decades, if not even longer.
Okay, well, there we go. We've got all your pig ear requirements. I think that's the first pig ear we've had in the pod, right?
It is. I think it is.
Yeah.
It's nice to have some specific recommendations for listeners, Benjamin. Thank you. And actually, speaking of specifics, sort of zooming out of food, what are some highlights that listeners shouldn't miss in the city at large?
Yeah, well, I would say that a lot of the most exciting things happening in food right now are happening in the markets. And when I say markets, I don't mean the place where you just go and buy, you know, your fruit, your meat, your poultry and go home. Mm-hmm. But rather markets that are these kind of hybrid establishments now where you can, yes, you can go and buy your fruit, but you can also have, you know, a 3-course meal at a really funky restaurant. Part of the reason why a lot of the culinary vanguard is happening in the markets is because the overhead to open a stall in a market is much lower than it is to open a brick and mortar restaurant. And so what you have is, you know, younger people who would otherwise maybe be priced out of the restaurant market find an opportunity to plant some roots and to experiment. And the whole thing is just really fun. You know, you go and oftentimes you're standing around, you're taking food from one stall and then from another stall, and you're kind of going to a central area with your friends. And you have kind of this feast where everybody's just standing around and talking and all that. And so specifically, I would recommend hitting up Mercado de San Fernando in the Lavapiés neighborhood. My favorite natural wine bar is there. It's called Bendito Vinos. I actually used to work there for a time. It's a fun little spot. And the owner there is friends with a lot of the Spanish winemakers. So you get really like limited release bottles. Sometimes the bottles don't even have labels on them. He's like, you know, this is from a friend who brought it in yesterday. And, you know, for natural wine lovers, doesn't really get much better than that. And then there's a market called Mercado de Vallehermoso, which I would say is sort of the culinary North Star of Madrid right now. Just there's so much interesting stuff happening there. There's a restaurant called Batch that that does sort of small plates. They're very seasonal, all complemented by small production, mostly natural wines. They also sell like fermented products and jars of stuff that you look at and you're like, what's that? And I need it right now. And then there's also a restaurant in there called El Dos, like the number two. And that spot's been getting really great reviews. It's high on my list and I'd recommend that people check it out as well.
I am super hungry.
Yeah.
I think it's all of this food chat. I really hope this can't hear my stomach rumble.
Yeah, so another thing that a lot of people don't know about Madrid that I learned when I got here is that Madrid has a pretty diverse immigrant community. And especially there are pretty large Chinese and West African immigrant populations here, which translates into surprisingly excellent Chinese food and especially Senegalese food. And so there's a Chinatown in Madrid that most people don't even know exists, and it's on the other side of the river. It's called Uceda. And it's unlike any Chinatown that I've been to in the U.S., where it feels a little bit Disneyfied in some ways. This is really a place where Chinese people are living. They're going to their own restaurants. They are, living in a very tight-knit community. And so to see that and to have it not be any type of tourist attraction at all is something that I would recommend to any food lover who enjoys getting off the beaten path.
Cool. Are there any specific recommendations of where you've loved to go in Chinatown?
I was thinking about this before the call, and the places that I love to go to most actually have, they're like on Google Maps, they're just Chinese characters. Right. I don't even know what they're called. I couldn't tell you. But what I can say is that if you just walk around in that area, if you get off the metro at the Uceda stop and just walk around that area, you're going to find some really banging Chinese food.
Excellent. Any further Madrid highlights?
Yeah, there's one more. I don't know if your listeners, I imagine they do, if they enjoy, traditional ceramics, housewares, artisanally made Spanish products. But one thing that I've really loved seeing in recent years is sort of a return to, Spain's artistic history. They're in restaurants right now. I'm noticing that there a lot of people are serving their dishes on, plates that are 100 years old, or things that you would see at your grandma's house that maybe even 5-10 years ago would have been considered like too old hat or tacky. But the square plate, which, you know what I mean by when I say like the square plate, like when you go to a restaurant, and they give you a dish on a plate and it's square and it usually has a tuft of microgreens on top and some sauce like squirted around the sides.
Yeah.
Thankfully, that is on its way out in Spain. And I'm noticing more and more kind of simple preparations presented on the types of plates that, say, your abuela would have given you. I think people are seeking comfort after the pandemic, and that's a part of it. Anyway, to stock up on those things, I recommend this store called Cocol, C-O-C-O-L, and it's on one of the most beautiful squares in Madrid, Plaza de la Paja, which is where a lot of the city's commerce happened even before the Plaza Mayor became the main character. And at that store, you can find all sorts of stuff. They have linens, they have beautifully made ceramics, antique wicker baskets. Anyway, I can't go in there and not drop like $100. So if you are on a budget, actually, maybe don't go.
It's quite dangerous. It's,
yeah.
If you want your budget to be gone immediately, there you go. But no square plates in sight then, Benjamin, I'm guessing.
No, not in there.
Okay, so, and you may have covered this already, Benjamin. I think there's quite a lot that we've already gone through in terms of like best kept secrets. But are there any other best kept secrets around Madrid that you'd be willing to share with us?
Definitely. A couple more come to mind. You know, the classic spot to go and get churros, which, as your listeners probably know, are those long donuts, basically. Most people in Madrid go straight to San Ginés, which is sort of like, if you've been to New Orleans, the like Café du Monde. It's just super famous. It's a traditional kind of iconic spot. But to me, the churros at San Ginés are good, but they're not great. And what's really not great there is the melted chocolate. It's just not great quality. So I always recommend that people go to San Ginés for the vibes. And then if they really love churros, you should go to a place called Chocolat, which is like chocolate, but in French. And it's a pretty small churreria, and they make all the churros to order. So they're always really hot, really crackly. I recommend getting a mixture of churros and porras, which are kind of, porras are like churros, but they're thicker, they're chewier, they have baking soda in them. So they're kind of have a wider kind of chewier crumb to them. And at this place, the chocolate's actually pretty decent. So, yeah, go to Chocolat, have some churros, have some porras, and, yeah, live it up. That's a a good tip.
We need to stop doing these episodes near lunchtime, Lucy. This is really horrible.
I can honestly. Really struggling. I'm so hungry. Apologies.
That's great. That's great, Benjamin. And yeah, I would absolutely love a churro right now. Yeah. Any other best kept secrets as well that you can let some listeners in on?
For sure. There's another. So Madrid is a taberna town. You know, Rome has its trattorias. London has its pubs, and Madrid has its taverns, its tabernas. And when you say taberna, we're talking about a place where you go and you usually stand at the bar. You have a stemless glass of whatever the house wine is, whatever tapa the barman gives you. And these places are kind of endangered, and they're few and far between. But there are a few that that still exist today. And surprisingly, the oldest tavern in Madrid, which was opened in 1787, is still in existence. And I think the last time it was renovated was like 150 years ago or something. And so you really get a sense of how restaurants and taverns used to be in Madrid, you know, before international immigration, definitely before the Civil War. And so this particular tavern, it's called Antonio Sanchez. And it has a little bit of fun trivia to it. They say that, you know, in the basement of this tavern, there are all these wine containers, these kind of big clay jugs where they used to store wine. You know, wine up until fairly recently, maybe 40 years ago, would actually arrive to taverns and restaurants around Madrid in bulk, often in goat skins and sheepskins. And these would be emptied into these underground, these basements where you'd have these urns where, you know, you'd fill them with wine, and then you would take that wine up to the bar. And that's how people would get their wine. Anyway, in this tavern, you have all these kind of cobwebbed clay vats in the basement. And one of them is called La del Francés, which means the Frenchman's clay vat. And the reason for that, we're getting into some obscure food, Madrid food history here.
I love it. It's great.
So they say that during the Peninsular War, which was the beginning of the 19th century, in Madrid, you had, the French were invading, and, you know, Napoleon's troops were invading. And they say that some gangs in the neighborhood actually got hold of one of these Frenchmen and decided that they were going to kill him. And so they brought him into this tavern. And so that the French armies wouldn't find his body, they hacked him up and put him in this Frenchman's wine vat in the basement. And people, they say, would go, and to sort of celebrate their victory over the French and to curse the French, they would go and have the wine from this vat. So I don't think that that's true. I couldn't really find any proof of it. But it certainly is a fun, colorful story that maybe says a lot about Spanish society or something. I don't know.
I wasn't expecting anything quite that grisly, I must say.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
So just to double check, they're not using that to serve wine now or anything, right?
Oh, no. That is still in existence. They're not filling it with wine anymore.
Okay.
But you can go. Actually, if you ask them, they'll usually take you downstairs and you can go and see it.
That's cool. Yeah.
That is cool.
I would want to see it, to be fair. It's grisly, but I would want to see it.
Amazing. On the taverna point of as well, like, what is it that's kind of like been threatening them? You say that they're kind of like dying out. Is it kind of restaurant culture? Is it internationalism? Like Madrid being a kind of big capital city? Why are they not as kind of frequent in Madrid as they historically would have been?
A couple reasons. One is that I think people don't drink like they used to. These were places that you would go on your lunch break and you'd have, right after work, and you'd have one or two or three glasses of wine, you'd have some tapas. And I think that the way people are, you know, relating to alcohol has changed a little bit. Also, of course, you have, lots of franchises and bigger chain restaurants that are pushing these smaller taverns out. Mm. But it's heartening because when you go to these places, you often see very young people. So I would say that the new generation of madrileños and tourists as well are helping this, you know, keeping these older places alive. You know, I would say that sometimes the quality isn't quite as good as what you're going to get at a more modern Spanish restaurant. For instance, at the place I just mentioned, like Antonio Sanchez, I actually would not recommend eating there. I would recommend going there ordering a beer or a glass of wine, sitting under the taxidermy bullheads, looking around, you know, oohing and aahing, and then going on your merry way to eat somewhere else. But I think there's a way that you can still go into these places, appreciate them for what they are, without having to maybe commit to the full taberna experience if that's not what you're looking for.
Mm. Yeah, great advice. And I think we'll come on to that idea of sort of eating and drinking, I imagine, at more kind of local places in the next section. But before we do move on, Benjamin, how about sort of just zooming out of Madrid and thinking about the surrounding region? Do you have any experiences that you would champion sort of just outside of Madrid?
Definitely. Well, of course, a lot of my experiences that I would recommend are related to food, because all I do is think about food.
That's all we all do. You're not alone with that.
But there are lots of day trips that you can do outside Madrid. One that I particularly enjoy is going to El Escorial, which has this beautiful old kind of palace fortress situation. But what I love about it is, yes, the palace is beautiful, of course, but there's a restaurant there called Casa Carola that serves to what is to me the best cocido madrileño, that that's Spanish Madrid stew with the garbanzo beans and all the pork products. They make the best version, at least in my view, at that restaurant. So, you know, you go to El Escorial, maybe you walk around the palatial grounds, you go for a little hike because you're also in the mountains up there. And then once you're done, you kind of settle in for a big old lunch at Casa Carola.
Sounds great. Sounds brilliant.
Perfect day out.
Yeah.
So, you know, the classic day trips from Madrid are Toledo, which is the old capital of Spain. It's where El Greco was born. It's where Jews, Muslims, and Christians lived in relative peace, at least for the era. And so you can still go and find some of Spain's most best preserved medieval and even like, you know, pre-medieval buildings, including a couple of synagogues and things like that. So Toledo is amazing. And then there's also Segovia, which is a bit smaller than Toledo. It's famous for the aqueduct. It has this incredible Roman aqueduct that's held together by nothing, just pure engineering. And Segovia is, I would say, almost as beautiful, if not more beautiful, because you have the backdrop of the mountains. And it's a bit more manageable than Toledo. Like, if you're a real history buff and you love museums and architecture, I'd say go to Toledo. But if you're more interested in, you know, culture and kind of meandering through one car wide streets, then Segovia is probably your best bet.
Cool.
Amazing. Well, I think there's just so much to unpack from Madrid there. Thank you so much for your recommendations, Benjamin. And let's go on to discuss a little bit more about Madrid's present and future.
With world-class museums, a rich literary heritage, and legendary nightlife, Madrid is the cultural epicentre of Spain and an embodiment of the best the country has to offer. Whatever your dream trip entails, your DK Eyewitness Madrid travel guide is the perfect companion.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Benjamin, we sort of touched a bit on this in the last section, but tell us how visitors can explore Madrid a little more thoughtfully.
You know, that's a great question. I think a lot of us are thinking about how we can travel in a more respectful way, which is, it's just really nice that that's what people are talking about now. I think for a long time, that just wasn't even part of the conversation. So I appreciate the question. I think the biggest thing that I always recommend to people who are coming here is to actually stay in a hotel as opposed to renting an Airbnb. Airbnbs are actually not even fully legal here. There's a lot of kind of murkiness in terms of the legality of a lot of the Airbnbs that are being rented in Madrid. And, you know, I recommend this not because I hate Airbnb. I mean, I actually stay in Airbnbs sometimes when I travel. But in Madrid specifically, more than many other European cities, has experienced an enormous increase in rent prices in the last few years. I was actually just looking at some statistics about this, and in the last 10 years, rents have gone up 62%. Now, if you think that Spanish incomes have gone up 62%, then you are like completely out of your mind because, yeah. You know, Spanish salaries are fairly low compared to the UK and certainly compared to the US. And so and people who rent are, of course, in the most kind of precarious position in society. Mm-hmm. And so what's happening is that Airbnb is pushing a lot of you know, everyday renters out of their apartments, including the elderly, including families, including people with disabilities. And that's something that's not getting much press abroad, but we certainly read about it here. And, you know, the sort of silent killer is these Airbnbs and these sort of rentable apartments that a lot of travelers stay in. And they have no idea that maybe the tenants that were staying there before them were a family that really needed the apartment and that the law just didn't quite protect.
Yeah, I think it's across quite a lot of like European cities. I know Lisbon and Barcelona have had like kind of really, really similar issues too. And I think it's one that travelers can be quite aware of. On the flip side of that as well, in terms of like hotels and hotel culture, Benjamin, I guess they've had a really tough time in the pandemic as well. And actually, you know, there are lots of like big chain hotels, but then there are lots of like smaller guest houses and stuff as well, right? I don't know if that's that much of a culture in Madrid.
Gosh, you know, I wish I could tell you that I had like a favorite boutique hotel in Madrid that's independently owned and that's serving traditional Spanish products. And I frankly, I can't say that. And I wish I could. People, when they ask me for hotel recommendations, I often kind of draw a blank. So I guess I'm really giving people conflicting advice here. I mean, I'm saying don't rent an Airbnb, but also, you know, most of the hotels are big chains. There are a couple that do have some personality and that are locally owned. One that I do recommend pretty frequently is Posada del León. It's in the city center. It's right on the main kind of tapas drag called Cava Baja. They also have a really good wine list. But yeah, you know, if anybody's listening out there and wants to open an independently run, gorgeous little hotel in Madrid, I would love to see that happen.
Do it. Please do it.
Hopefully this is a start of something.
The other thing I would say is that, and maybe this goes without saying, but a little Spanish really does go a long way. Spain is not like a lot of Latin American countries where, you know, the English level can be pretty good among people of almost all ages, especially in the cities. In Madrid, it's possible and even probable that you're going to find yourself in situations where someone does not speak English or refuses to. You know, the older generation, especially, you know, English was not a huge focus of education until the last few decades. And so if you go into a traditional market or a traditional tapas bar, the person taking your order might not speak a damn word of English. And so it just pays to at least to try. You know, people like to see that you're trying. And then maybe they'll try, you know, then you always figure it out, right? But just always starting with an hola, a buenos dias when you walk into a store. It just goes a really long way instead of walking in and kind of saying hello right off the bat.
Speak English, etc.
Yeah, table two, please. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, okay, got it. Great. And so thinking a little bit more in the sort of present and, you know, what's left of 2023, if anyone's looking to visit Madrid around the corner, are there any particular events coming up to mark which, you know, visitors should particularly look out for?
In mid-August, there's a really fun street party called Fiestas de la Paloma, which celebrates the patron saint of the La Latina neighborhood. So one thing that's really fun about Madrid is that every neighborhood has its own kind of street party. And La Paloma is one of the best. And it's great because it happens in mid-August, which is a time when there really aren't many tourists coming to Spain because it's so damn hot here. And also a lot of Madrileños, especially ones who don't live in the city, they've skipped town because they're on the beach. And so what you get at La Paloma is a festival that really does feel kind of local. And, you know, we're talking about people grilling Spanish sausages out in the street and cooking up churros also in the street. And, you know, people with boomboxes and kind of impromptu dance parties and just big, you know, big plastic cups filled with all sorts of strange alcoholic concoctions. It's a really good time. You know, of course, there are concerts and all sorts of organized things too. But yeah, La Paloma is really great. Also, you know, one street party that we unfortunately just missed, but people should definitely keep in mind for next year, is the Fiestas de San Isidro, which happen in May. And it's sort of a similar vibe to La Paloma, but it's a little bit more manageable temperature-wise because it's in May. That festival in particular has all sorts of incredible live concerts at all the parks around the city. It's really a raucous, fun time. And frankly, for people who want to enjoy something like a carnival, like Carnaval or San Fermín in Pamplona, but maybe are a little put off by the bullfighting, like I am, San Isidro and these types of parties are just, it's just pure, you know, pure fun.
Great.
Okay, we'll book in for next year.
Definitely. Actually, Benjamin, a question I have is how about sort of like seasonally? What would you suggest is the best time to visit Madrid? What time of year?
Wow. I think Madrid is a really great shoulder season town. I always recommend people come in like, you know, between April and the end of May. And then, yeah, you know, September, October are just perfect. Because Madrid really does have an extreme temperature that's just getting worse and worse every year because of the climate crisis. You know, you just don't want to be in the street in July and in August. And especially doing, you know, heavy tourism. If it's your first time in Spain and you come in July or August, you really want, you know, that's probably not the best plan because you want to make the most of your time. So I would recommend those kind of shoulder season months. You know, November, December, January. The winter here is chilly. It's not super cold, but it can be rainy. And, you know, one thing that I've noticed without fail is I'm a Scorpio. My birthday is November 9th. And every single year it's raining on my birthday. So it's not a very scientific study, but I would say that don't come in November and expect to be dry.
That's fair enough. I know there's a big heat wave going on right now, Benjamin. Yeah. So thanks for joining us today. I'm sure it's very, very warm right now. But yeah, it's been wonderful to get to know Madrid with you, Benjamin. You've painted such a wonderful picture of it. I'm sure you've inspired lots of listeners to go. So thank you so much. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Well, a huge, huge thank you to Benjamin. James, the minute we finish this recording, yes, I think we're both going to go make a large snack.
Yes. Yeah. I'm trying to think, where can I get Spanish food from that's local to here? There's nowhere. Benjamin, you've really, really put us through a lot of pain on that one. But no, it was a really delicious episode. Like, so much to savour. And as we were talking about at the top of the episode, Madrid is one place that I just haven't been in Spain. I love Spain as a country. And I certainly think we need to make our mission to go in 2024, Lucy.
Definitely. Yeah. Let's do it, James. Let's stop talking about it and let's just do it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So thanks so much to Benjamin. You can follow his adventures on Twitter at Ben K. Kemper and on Instagram at Benjamin Kemper. And don't miss his column, One Pop Bangers, on Saveur.com. And I think, Lucy, we can call it a wrap on season 5.
That's a wrap.
That's a wrap, James.
Yeah.
So don't worry, listener. We have plans to be back very, very soon. But just to say from all of us, thank you for listening this season. We've had so many great adventures. And, you know, from New Zealand to Norway to, where do we, I'm trying to
Vienna.
Remember. Vienna. Where did we start, Lucy? Where was the first episode?
Sicily,
yeah. Wow. With Ross all those months ago. So
I know.
Yeah, we've travelled vicariously through our guests and, you know, alongside you guys. So a big thank you to all of our guests, all of our listeners and all of the team at Decare Witness as well. It's been a really, really fun one to make. So we will be back with more incredible guests and destinations later in the year. Stay tuned. But for now, it's goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.
And we shall see you very soon. Where to Go is a podcast from DK Eyewitness. It was produced by Julia Baker, presented by Lucy Richards and James Atkinson with the help of Bella Talbot. For more information about DK Eyewitness, follow us on social media at DK Eyewitness or visit dk.com/eyewitness. And please like and follow the show. And if you have time, leave a review. Your support means so much to us.
She lived with you guys for 2 years and you never heard from her again after that.
Please don't text me or call me again.
She'd finished her art history degree and was researching a Swiss painter, Ursula Bloom.
He's standing by a tree, looking right at me.
Emma!
Music is 100% abstract.
Ursula walked up to her and whispered a song in her ear, and the girl recovered her ability to speak.
Sometimes mythology merges with reality.
What's going on here?
Bloom is out now. Listen to it on your favorite podcasting platform.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.